Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system.
Welcome back to A New Prescription. I'm your co-host, Andrew Zwelling. We have a lot to get to today. But of course, I need to introduce and say hello to my co-host, Dr. Leonard A. Zwelling. Dad, say hello to our people.
Hey, people. I'm here and ready to go.
So, Dad, before we get to our main topic, the day in the life of a GP, I want to first talk about what's going on in current news with RFK Jr.'s confirmation hearing for the Secretary of HHS. So, yes. If those of you who don't know, he was tapped by President Trump to be the secretary for HHS. Dad, I first want to get your opinion of his nomination, but even before that, what is the HHS and why is it important in our lives?
Okay, HHS stands for Health and Human Services. It is basically one of the large secretarial positions in the executive branch of government. It's sanctioned by the Congress. And basically, it oversees all the other agencies involved with healthcare, Food and Drug Administration, the CDC, the NIH, all the federal research is under there, Medicare Services is under there. It's a very huge trillion-dollar budget. It's a huge job.
And what can the HHS affect in everyday lives? How does it affect people in their everyday lives?
Well, I think because of Medicare and Medicaid services, the reimbursement that doctors get for caring for people is affected by HHS. The research that is done that leads to new treatments is affected because Health and Human Services, it incorporates the NIH. And lastly, the CDC, they're in charge of public health in the country. And so they were a large part of the response to COVID. And they also under HHS. So it affects everyday Americans in a very real way.
So needless to say, this is a very important position, a cabinet member within Trump's administration. So let's get to the appointee, RFK Jr. What are your thoughts on them? He's a very controversial figure. It looks like he's maybe narrowly going to pass confirmation. What is your take on his nomination?
Well, I think the most important thing to look at with any of these nominations is, does the individual have the qualifications for the job? Do they have a past history in managing large institutions? And do they have a past history in the area of healthcare? And I don't think that Mr. Kennedy, he has a lot of very credible attributes in environmental legal issues, which sort of come under Health and Human Services, more under the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. But in terms of true health management, he really doesn't have a lot of history. And the history he does have involving health, as you point out, incredibly controversial. Is he or isn't he for vaccines? What was his position during COVID? Has he really sued the federal government with regard to use of COVID vaccines? In general, he's highly controversial and a very unusual choice for this job, especially considering in early 2024, he was running for president as a Democrat. So it's really pretty crazy to appoint him for this job. That being said, it looks like, as you say, he will be approved by the Senate, and we are going to have to see how he manages this huge bureaucracy.
Why is it important to have the experience prior to getting a job like Secretary of HHS?
Because you are going to have to figure out what the president wants, or he'll tell you what he wants. You have to figure out a way to make this huge bureaucracy move in that direction and succeed. And being able to pull those levers really takes skill and experience, when I was an administrator of a far, far smaller organization, you really had to figure out and learn how you push, how you pull, how you negotiate. And I think one of the things that this particular administration seems to be not terribly good at is negotiating, at least not yet. My guess is that Donald Trump will turn out to be a skilled negotiator and will come up with middle grounds for some of the things he wants to do. We don't really know what he wants to do in HHS. That's still unclear, other than to shrink the budget. We do know that. And this very week, there was a dictum that came out to reduce the overhead on federal grants to 15%. That is the amount of money that institutions that get grants receive over and above the amount of the grant to pay for the support staff and the support infrastructure to make the research go. At MD Anderson, for example, that real number is 67%. Now it will be reduced to 15%. That means the institution is going to have to come up with a difference, or they're going to have to stop doing some research. That's a really big deal.
And was this, is this tied to the HHS, this decision, or was this outside the HHS?
No, this is within HHS. This is a particularly NIH decision. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I want to get back to RFK. He was a Democrat at one point, Democratic candidate. I think at best, he's a flip-flopper. At worst, he's dangerous. And I think that we specifically see that with his views on vaccines. I know there's been some, you know, podcasts where he said he was cut off too early, but there are other instances when he said he didn't believe in vaccines. I mean, have we really come to a time where we're questioning that the head of HHS may or may not be for vaccines?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's unclear where he stands. I think he's been all over the place. And I think that there are some points he makes that need to be considered. First off, there probably were too many COVID vaccines given to people. That's probably true. The best thing you can do to not get COVID is to first get COVID yourself, do well, survive that, and then you probably have the best antibody response to not getting it again. So that certainly is better than getting an mRNA vaccine. On the other hand, there probably were people that were saved, particularly elderly people who got the mRNA vaccine, got COVID, and survived it. So that's the COVID vaccine. I think what people are worried about are the vaccines that mostly kids get that are undoubtedly effective, like polio, like measles, like diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. Those vaccines have been shown to be incredibly effective, incredibly beneficial, and a lot of people are worried that, one, the government will interfere with your ability to get them, and perhaps more importantly, they have generated a skepticism in the population for the benefits that have been proven to derive from these vaccines. That's more concerning. That's what Bobby Kennedy has done. People doubt things that really work. That's bad.
And I think that extends also to his flip-flopping on abortion, where he was pro-choice, now he's pro-life.
Well, so was Trump. Trump was pro-choice when he was a Democrat in New York. So, you know, people are all over the place to try to get votes. I think the abortion business has been resolved in that the Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade. The decision now rests with the states. The federal government's role in this is probably limited. The only thing the federal government could possibly do is try to limit access to the abortion pills crossing state lines through interstate commerce legislation. But I don't think the federal government has a big role in abortion anymore.
So we've covered really three things: the vaccine, the abortion rights, the agency overview. what's your final take before we hear if he's going to be confirmed as head of HHS?
No, he'll be. I think he's going to be confirmed. I think the question is still in my mind, what does the Trump administration want to do with HHS? And is he capable of making it happen? The first salvo, which is the reduction in the indirect cost in the grants, is extremely concerning for those of us who are or have been in academic medicine. That's a real blow to academic medicine, which is a real blow to discovery of new medicines and new treatments in the United States. That's concerning.
So really, they've lowered the ability for these institutions to have federal grants of discovery, which will limit potential cures that they could find that impact people's health.
They haven't limited the access to grants. They've limited the access to money to pay for it. And if the institutions step up and pay for the difference, that's fine. But most of these institutions don't have that kind of wiggle room. They don't have that kind of money. So I think there's a real issue of where the money's going to come to from to pay for research. And it may mean that all really good therapeutic research now rests with the pharmaceutical industry, which is not where it's been in the past, but where it's going.
Now let's move on to our main story. And we have a guest. I am so happy to have her. She's Dr. Erin Rocchio, who earned her medical degree from Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine and completed her residency in internal medicine at Cleveland Clinic South Point Hospital in Warrensville. Please welcome Dr. Erin Rocchio, my cousin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today. So I practice outpatient internal medicine, primary care. I work as an employed physician at a group practice, a single specialty group practice, and I see patients exclusively in the outpatient setting. I don't do any hospital rounding at all.
So what is primary care? Because I want to make sure that our listeners understand what that term means at its basic level.
Primary care, I'm not sure where that term came from, but it encompasses the specialties of internal medicine and family practice doctors, and both of which can practice primary care. We essentially provide care for the human being, all care. So it could be my arm hurts, it could be I have abdominal pain, it could be chronic disease management, blood pressure, diabetes, gout, things like that. So we really do it all. And then we may refer to specialties for various things that we can't handle or that are a little bit too complicated or that we need some help in that way.
Is it fair to say you're like the central hub, the first stop before a patient goes to any of the spokes that are the massive healthcare system?
Yeah, they often call us the quarterbacks. So we are the first stop typically, or we should be, I would say, to get to the patient to the right place.
So on a given day, let's say a morning, let's make it easy. On a given morning, how many patients do you have to see?
So a full morning is between 10 to 12 patients. It's typically more like 10. And so that's over 4 hours.
And how many of those patients are new patients and how many are returns?
So it depends on where you are in your career. If you have an open panel, then it could be any variation of a mix of those two options. So if you're, let's say, brand new doctor starting out, 95% of your patients are new.
So the vast
majority, those would be new patients to me.
The vast majority of their patients you see are people you know.
Yeah.
Given that, how much time do you have to see each one?
Technically, we have 20 minutes allotted for each patient for problem visits. So that could be my arm hurts or I have diabetes and we need to address that. And then physical exams, which are considered an annual checkup, those we have 40 minutes. A lot of there's some competing health systems in our area that only allow 20 minutes for a physical exam. So that is different and our system is different in that way.
So what do they have to do? Do the physical exam at the same time they're taking a history? I mean, there's no way you can do a history and physical in 20 minutes.
Correct. I think it's very challenging in general to get everything done, and that's why I'm always running late. And I think that in specialty care, you often see much longer appointment slots, 40 minutes, 60 minutes for new patients, and they're there to address one issue. So it definitely feels frustrating, I think, on as the primary care doctor to see sort of how the specialists are treated and how much time they're given with the patient. Because there is very much an art to what we do. The answer is not referring everyone to cardiology for chest pain, for example. So it takes time to bring out the history. And like some people talk slowly, some people communicate in different ways, and they may start to tell you a story when you ask them, when did their chest pain start? And it takes a long time. And you really can try to hurry them along, but it can be challenging at times.
Yes. Now, the obvious question is, when do you have time to write all this down?
So what I usually do is I type whilst I talk to the patient. I am a very fast typer, and I can type without looking at the keyboard. So for me, I get most of it down when I'm in the room with the patient. I wish I didn't have to do that. There's actually some new AI tools that are hopefully in the future going to take out typing completely for us, or replace typing with, you know, the essentially scribing for us. But right now we don't have that in play. For they're doing a pilot study, so some physicians are using it, but not everybody.
Let's change this topic just a bit and talk about one of our favorite ones, insurance companies. Do you have to deal with them pretty regularly? And what's the biggest conversation you have with them?
Yeah, so we deal with them on a daily basis. The biggest interaction that I have with them is through prior authorizations, which is a process that certain medications on certain plans, like a patient has a plan and I prescribe a medicine that is not the right tier. And so it kicks back a prior authorization, which is paperwork that we have to do. It's essentially like a stopgap that the insurance company has put into place that says, no, I will not automatically pay for this until you give me this information. And it could be anything from verifying a diagnosis of diabetes. It could be verifying that the diabetes is poorly controlled and they want to know, when did you try these other medicines? When did the patient take them? What years? What was the treatment failure? You know, and it just really takes a lot of chart review, honestly. So that is very time consuming. And then occasionally I'll get a denial for a sleep study or a CT scan. And it's the same concept. They just want you to do something before it. They call them peer-to-peers, where you call your peer, so to speak. It's another physician, and they work for the insurance company, and they tell you, like, okay, why did you order this? We need this study. They supposedly use national guidelines to make their treatment decisions and use that to justify denials.
When they say peer-to-peer, you're an advocate for the patient. Your peer on the phone is an advocate for the insurance company. I'm not sure that's really peer-to-peer. Yeah. Everybody doesn't have the patient's best interest in mind in that peer-to-peer conversation. Does that ever slow things down? I mean, can you order a CT scan and find out right away that you need a pre-authorization, or is that you find that out later?
So with imaging, what, at least in our system, once they schedule the image, then it goes to this pool that manage the prior authorizations for imaging. And so they'll, once you schedule like the CT, it'll say needs a prior authorization, and then the department will pull the note, your office note, and send all the relevant scans, and then you'll get a letter saying if it was approved or not.
Sounds like a lot of bureaucracy between you and your patients. How do the patients feel? What did they ever express to you? This is a very frustration for them.
Oh, constantly. Yeah. I think
that. Back up, Aaron, do you have any specific stories where this has happened and it's had a very negative effect on a patient because they've gone through this process from start to finish and been denied.
Yeah, so I can think of a few people. I think the biggest issue with prior authorizations are some of the newer diabetes medications with Medicare patients specifically. So a lot of the private insurances will cover these newer medications, specifically GLP-1s, SGLT-2s. Some of the brand names are Jardiance, Farxiga, Ozempic, Mounjaro. So with Medicare patients, they have every patient has a different plan, and so they have different coverage, and that means their copays are all different. And so I had one patient who was poorly controlled diabetes. He had high blood pressure that was adequately controlled, and over time, he wasn't able to get the medications, the SGLT2s or the GLP-1. So we were using metformin, we were using glyburide, things that are cheap but are not necessarily the most up to date therapy, and so because of that, he couldn't afford the insurance copay. And so he couldn't get the medicine. And so he went through the drug company's program for income-based qualifications. You could get the medicine for free. So he was doing that for Trulicity. And so at some point, he couldn't get the medicine. And it may have just been he stopped sending in the documents, or it needed to be recertified, essentially paperwork. And we lost touch with him for maybe 3 or 4 months. And then when he came back, he presented to the ER for an acute complaint, and he was in kidney failure. So he went from, poorly controlled diabetic with chronic kidney disease that, was not even close to becoming that severe, not going to be on dialysis, to basically being prepped for dialysis, and he's going to start dialysis soon. I think very clearly that the insurance companies are withholding life-saving medications from patients. I think that's very clear. And I think that from where I sit, what's hard is that everyone just kind of sits around and says, well, this is just what we have here in America. This is our insurance system. This is our payer system. And this is what we have to deal with. But, I think that if we can shed some of that, well, this is how we always do it, and be committing to changing, that maybe we can get some, just get some uniform coverage of certain medications. And I think there's something that came out of the White House maybe a year or two ago about certain medications that they were going to cap the price. I think Jardiance, insulin, Farxiga, maybe a few others. So it's frustrating.
Is it tougher with patients insured by Medicare or tougher with patients who have private insurance?
I have a lot of Medicare patients, and I think that the more expensive medications, the newer medications, the medications that are coming out, as I mentioned, as an example, the SGLT2s, there's some newer medications for urinary incontinence that are essentially cutting edge. They have fewer side effects, and they're just better medications, and no Medicare patient is going to be able to get that med unless they're paying out of pocket. I mean, there may be exceptions, but I'm talking about like your average Medicare patient who's living on a fixed income, isn't working, doesn't have, a fancy car. They might have like $1,000 to $2,000 a month for all of their expenses. So it's just not in their budget to pay, $100+.
I think that the administrative processes and blocking people from getting the medication that they need is really killing people. And I don't want to put it any more lightly than that. Aaron, I think you probably see it every day. You say it needs to change. What can we do as a society? Is it on the administration level that it needs to change? Is it on the individuals like myself? Is it the doctors? Is it the patients to demand these change? And how can we get these changes happening so this isn't occurring anymore?
It's a great question. I don't have a perfect answer, but I will say, I've thought about it because it is so frustrating that I see this every day. And I think the first thing I think of is just start talking with your peers, with your family, and and kind of like saying, this is not okay. This is not okay that we're doing this to people. And that person, you know, that I was talking about is someone's brother, father, husband. And just because it's not me, it doesn't mean it's not important. So I think brewing this sense of unrest, like, it's not okay.
So I want you to go back for just a second and think about medical school and think about whether this is what you thought you'd be doing when you were in medical school and whether you were trained to do any of this in medical school.
I was not trained to do paperwork in medical school. This is not medicine. This is very much, you know, office work. I think that we were trained to empathize with patients. We were trained to make sure we take a thorough history so that we are not missing, you know, food insecurity or, you know, why aren't they taking their medications because, like, they can't get to the pharmacy because they have to walk there and the pharmacy is a, you know, a driving distance as opposed to a walkable distance. So I think we were trained to seek out those details and certainly the medical side of things as well. But, you know, they call them social determinants of health, and there's a lot of things can fit into that umbrella. It could be income, it could be zip code, it could be access to healthy food, clean water, you know, the list goes on. So I think that at the kind of base of all of this is that we are all humans and we all need the same things to thrive and to live long lives. You know, that if I live in a wealthier zip code than, you know, the person down the street, I'm going to live longer. And it's not because of my magical genes, right? It's because of my healthcare determinants of health, my social determinants of health are just better and they're going to help me live longer. So I think that that's we have to look at everyone as human and just, you know, say like, we need to treat this problem, this social problem that is, you know, very, very impactful in medicine, excuse me, and also is almost more impactful than the actual medical care that the patients receive.
So. That's right. We were not trained to be either politicians or sociologists, but in fact, we need to be both.
Really what you're saying at the crux of it is it needs to be universal, both on the pricing mechanism and the payment mechanism that can help you as a doctor, and that you weren't trained for a lot of what you're dealing with now. Are there any final words you'd like to say before we take off? I usually give that to my dad, but since you're our guests, I'm going to let you sign off for us with your final words and your thoughts for our viewers.
We need to expect more from our very costly healthcare system. And you know, we're paying a lot of money to have health insurance and we should get a little bit more for it. And I think outside of kind of local person-to-person conversations, I think trying to, on the larger scale, just establish sort of like a Medicare standard across all Medicare plans. This is how much things cost. It would simplify our lives, the patients' lives, and we would just say, okay, if we need this expensive medicine, this is what we have to do to get it. And it would just be like, this is the standard, that's it. You know, the buck stops there. So I think that would be really helpful. So some of those price capping measures, I think, would, you know, be extremely helpful to patients so they can get the medicine. And then I think, you know, it's a hot topic to say like national healthcare, single payer Medicare, you know, and I think trying to distance oneself from using that term and just say like establish rules and guidelines that are going to be nationwide for all Medicare plans, for example. So I think that would be really helpful. And I think lastly, just talking to your elected representatives about what you're experiencing, what you're going through, and just tell them your story and say like, hey, this happened to me. Like, why can't I get my medicine? Why is this so hard? And over time, when we all do that, I think it will make a difference.
And that's your final word. Thank you so much for joining us. Please follow us on our social media pages. Our handle is @anewprescription or on YouTube @anewprescription YouTube. And remember, your health is what matters the most, and we'll see you next time.